This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week we'll talk to a minor hockey referee who's getting fed up with rowdy spectators. A heads up, they'll soon be here from Mexico flying their colors, warning their enemies to stay away. In the dead of winter, a paranormal investigator is sharing stories about some of Sydney's oldest buildings. Also a conversation about young athletes going above the call of duty, and they're rolling out the red carpet for a Hall of Fame event featuring some of the island's best performers. These stories are coming up on the Coast. There's a video of a hockey game in Cape Breton making the rounds on the internet. You can hear some fans who are more than upset with the officials. We can't play it here because of the profanity. But a spectator was kicked out of the arena for hurling insults. We spoke with someone with a lot of experience calling the shots on the ice. Amanda McGinnis is the referee-in-chief for the Cape Breton Blizzard.
I grew up in Waikawa and played hockey there, mainly playing boys rep teams most of the way through till about midget. I was recruited by a couple of schools in the States, but things didn't really work out. And I've been an official since the last 15 years. In the last two, I became the referee-in-chief for the Blizzards.
So you have plenty of experience as a player when you were younger, and of course as an official. So you have seen times where fans have crossed the line when they're in the stands trying, and others are trying to enjoy the game?
Oh, absolutely. And that's something that, you know, I think when I started, you know, 15 years ago, and there wasn't a whole lot of female officials around at the time. You know, some of the things I was called and things that were hollered at me, you know, I guess I never really did anything about it at the time. And, you know, at that time, because I was a minority, I guess I just kind of shut my mouth and did my job. And, you know, today we do have a maltreatment rule that, you know, Hockey Nova Scotia with Hockey Canada, they put in place. And I think people are beginning to hammer down on that. You know, I think there's just this mindset that it's okay and normal when a part of the game to holler and scream and degrade officials, you know, whether it's a fan to an official or a coach to an official. And I think in society that's pretty sad, because I think if this was our everyday job, people would just quit and there'd be a million HR complaints. So, you know, when you think of that, it isn't normal. And I think, you know, the call that was made by a local official on the weekend to eject a fan, I think that it's a few fans. There's male voices, there's female voices. I've seen the actual unedited video where there was a lot of hollering and obscenities and degrading from the fans, and it was male and female voices. And he pointed to one and he ejected one of the fans out of the arena. Like any parent that's seen that's got a 14-year-old is probably going to think, like, oh, well, you're not going to be doing this next year if this is, you know what I mean, if this is the norm. Nobody would go to their everyday job and put up with that. You'd quit, you'd file an HR complaint, people would be fired. That would be the norm. And it's, you know, when you're in those situations, and I've been in them recently, where I did a U18 AA female game, and we had people follow us to our dressing room. And that causes a lot of anxiety, and it causes a lot of stress, and it makes it really hard to go back out and finish your job. I do, you know, think the green armband initiative is great to a fault. I think, you know, it makes people think, okay, well, I can't holler at him because he has a green armband, but I can holler at these other three people. So, you know, it's, there's pros and cons there, regardless of age, regardless of sex. If you're a first official or a first year official or someone that's been doing this for 20 years, it's still not appropriate.
When you have fans following you off the ice, like you mentioned there, Amanda, this sounds rather unsettling. Do you ever feel that you should call for help or to the authorities to make sure that you get a safe escort out of the arena?
I guess I never felt like I had to call the authorities. It's happened to me twice this year. And in the last, all my 15 years of doing it, it's probably been about almost, a dozen times, I guess, that I've been in a situation like that. There were times where I've done games and, myself and other officials, we waited, till we knew teams and crowds and fans were gone, because we didn't really feel like it was best for us to walk through the rink. I've been doing this for 15 years and I always kind of loved it and being able to move up into higher leagues and get some of them bigger games. And I kind of found probably more so the last 2 years that I'm almost, getting an assignment and dreading it, because you just don't know what you're getting into anymore.
And when tempers are flaring, and the recent game that we were talking about, the video that's on the internet, it must have taken a lot of courage for him to approach this individual in an already heated situation.
Oh, I agree. And that's the thing. I think you're going to have a crew of people that are going to stand behind him on that, and I'm definitely one of them. And there's going to be a lot of people that have zero experience in this, small type hobby profession, that are going to be against him for that. But, that's not what anybody's job is to go out there and get hollered and screamed at. And it makes it very hard to do your job. So I think we have to kind of move forward in showing that this isn't normal. We have to start getting rid of these people.
Would you say these parents and fans who engage in that kind of rhetoric and that hurling insults like that from the stands, would you say they're few and far between?
Honestly, I kind of find it depends and it varies. I think sometimes the level of hockey and the age group, it can depend on how much, garbage you're going to hear from the crowd. And even from the benches. It's not always the crowd, right? A lot of times, the benches get just as hot, and that's not appropriate either. And, they're the role model on the bench for the kids that are sitting there. So the team that I did, back in January, where I had parents follow me to the dressing room, I haven't done one of their games since. Because of that reason, just because I just don't have it in me. I don't want to have to go through that again. So, I guess seeing that they're playing home or whatever kind of creates a little bit of anxiety in me, and that I might be on that game.
What kind of reaction do you see from the players when there's a confrontation between the officials and people watching the game?
Honestly, I am not sure. I've never gotten a player's perspective on it. I will say, for the most part, a lot of the players, any type of, maltreatment from them, it's usually player to player, I find, is the majority of it. And we're able to handle that through, multiple rules, and we can kind of get these people off the ice, but it is a little bit harder to start getting people out of a rink.
In your opinion, as referee-in-chief for the Cape Breton Blizzard, what would you like to say about recruiting young officials and referees to participate in minor hockey games in Cape Breton when, sometimes we have to deal with these types of confrontations in the arenas?
Yeah, I've been trying to recruit the last 2 years, and even, when I'm in different arenas and see different faces or whatever, I kind of start asking around as to who they are and then kind of send them an email and see if they'll come and do a few games for me as well.
Yes, well, they'll certainly have their work cut out for them. Unfortunately, it can be a very difficult task.
It is difficult because it seems so acceptable for them to do it. So if I was standing on the ice and I'm leaving the ice, and if I started hollering back at a fan, like, people would just think I was, you know, crazy and unprofessional. And that's also sad, because I guess our next option is to get rid of them, like, to get them out of the rink. And people are going to take that whatever way they want to as well. And I mean, and like, when our playing career is done and we begin doing this, like, we still have the camaraderie in the dressing room as officials, and you still have a team and you're still a part of that. And I, you know, I guess that's kind of what's kept me going, is the people that I get to do games with and work with that have become, you know, friends and comrades over the years. And that's, I guess, kind of what keeps me in it, and kind of why I don't leave. But we're kind of battling through this together now, right?
Okay. Thanks so much for your time, Amanda. Best of luck to you out there, and hopefully we'll get a chance to chat again soon. Have a good one.
Yeah, for sure. You too.
To the lighter side of hockey, the Cape Breton Blizzard hockey team isn't only busy on the ice. Bill Bradley and Christine Alamy will tell us ways they are chipping in to help others less fortunate.
Hockey season just about coming to a close here, coming up close to the end of March for the Cape Breton Blizzard's female hockey team. But they're always out canvassing the community to see what they can do to help out others. And Christine Alamy's with me here this morning. She's the president of Cape Breton Blizzard's hockey. First of all, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Bill.
And I'm sure it's something that you instill and your female hockey players to give back to the community. Not only do you play hockey in this community, but it's always great to give back to people that are really in dire straits, especially over the last couple of years for all the things that have been happening with us.
Yes, well, I always kind of joke that it's partly a hockey association and partly a girls' leadership program. So at the end of the day, you know, working out with our colleagues there up in Halifax, they started a food drive and they collected 890 items. So they challenged us to try to match or exceed that. So, of course, we must step up. That's where we're at right now. We're going to exceed what the Halifax Metro Force Association had raised in their community.
You know, when another team from off island, i.e. Halifax, makes a request like that, you got to take up the challenge, because we as Cape Bretoners got to prove our worth as well.
Yeah, it's almost like we can't help ourselves.
That's true. That's true.
Halifax says, we did something better than you. And what do we say? Hold my Tim Hortons here for a second, and away we go.
So this is coming up on March the 5th. Tell us a bit about what people can do to help out with this food drive.
Generally speaking, all the Blizzard players are collecting food donations right now, and they're doing drop-offs at the Member 2 Arena on our ticket drop day on Sunday the 5th and Sunday the 12th. So I'd say reach out to the Blizzard players that you know of. You probably see them all on Facebook and the families and everything, and make a food donation to them. They'll come pick it up and make a donation to that overall total that we're trying to reach.
It's food donations, but also hygiene products as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. If anybody wants to drop something off themselves, the best place and time to do that is the next two Sundays between noon and 3 at the Member 2 Arena.
And is there a phone number? If somebody wants to get more information, maybe they want to get together like collectively as a group to drop off something.
Best thing to do is email us at info@capebretonblizzard.ca.
So the challenge is out there. So how much did you say Halifax has raised so far?
They had collected, when they did their drive, they collected 890 items. So obviously we're looking to surpass that. So we're counting by items. So yeah, so we'd love to get some amounts from some people. That would be wonderful.
So you got to get at least 1,000 to shame them.
Oh, yes. Exactly.
Always great to talk to you. I know the Blizzard's female hockey always doing great things in the community. And when I saw this, I said, this is a perfect opportunity to talk to Christina, see what's up with hockey. So the hockey season coming to an end very soon as we get ready for the March break. Looking forward to that big game coming up in the fall, which we still still don't know yet when it's going to happen and who it's going to be, right?
No, I don't have the exact date yet or the exact naming of the teams. I believe we're expecting that to be announced in June, actually.
Nice.
So kind of we're still waiting to hear as well and eager to kind of get started on all of the activity that will be happening around that. And importantly, too, keeping the ball moving and keeping everything moving forward with the plans to reopen the Canada Game Center at CBU to be a home ice for our program.
Well, I appreciate this and good luck with the food drive.
Thank you very much, Bill. Appreciate it.
Right now, the monarch butterflies are beginning to emerge from their winter sleep in Mexico, getting ready to begin the journey north to lay their eggs as the subsequent generations make their way to the northern region and finally reach us in Cape Breton. The generation that hatches here will fly all the way to Mexico to reach a special forest to spend the winter. This month, the Mercy Tobiatic Research Institute is asking you to march for monarchs. Carter Feltham is a researcher with the Institute. She'll talk about the mysterious insect, how their orange and black colors warn off predators, and how you can help them get safely from one end of the continent to the other.
The monarch butterfly is a large, iconic orange butterfly. It has those bright orange wings with black veins and some white specks along the edge of the wing. And you'll also see it flying towards the end of summer around. As a caterpillar, the monarch will consume a plant that contains a toxin for that purpose of keeping predators away from it.
So the orange and black colors for the butterfly, are those colors the result of their diet?
So monarch caterpillars will only eat milkweed plants within the Asclepiaceae family.
Okay, and on to another interesting fact about the monarch butterfly, the journey between Canada and Mexico. Can you talk a little bit about that? That's really fascinating when you think of the thousands of kilometers that are necessary in order for them to lay their eggs.
Sure thing. So when the monarch emerges from Mexico, it actually moves slightly north and it breeds and reproduces, and then that generation moves a little further north, and it takes about three generations to actually reach us in Nova Scotia. The really amazing part of this butterfly is the generation that is born here will make the trip all the way to Mexico by itself, so in one straight shot journey, which is about a 5,000 kilometer trip. And it does this to reach its overwintering site where the temperatures and climate are perfect for it to spend the winter and survive to start that journey again in the spring.
They certainly are resilient little creatures. It's really hard to wrap your head around that.
They are, and it takes the strongest and the best to make the journey. And that's what we start out the new generations with, is always the strongest and the best. Unlike the other generations, the one that comes from Nova Scotia, that is the big, long shot that it does. And once it emerges in the spring and reproduces, it will pass away. And its children will continue that journey forward to make it back up north, where the cycle keeps repeating itself.
And what incredible instincts to be able to find their way back and forth from Mexico. What type of navigation resources does the monarch butterfly use to come back and forth?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of factors that go into it, and I'm sure we don't know everything that actually is involved and how many ways they find their way. On their way north, they follow the milkweed because that is what they need to start the next generation. And on the way back, they use environmental cues to tell them when to go and where to go.
So how fast do they travel, and how long does the journey take approximately?
That's actually something I'm not sure. I know that they begin to leave Nova Scotia in late October-ish time. It all depends on how the weather's going at the end of the season. And then they fly all the way down to Mexico, and then they spend a few months over wintering there. And roughly about now in March is when they begin to emerge again and start that journey again.
How safe is the passage for the monarch butterfly? Do they have to deal with or encounter a lot of predators along the way?
Yes, they do have a lot of threats, and of course, because they make such a large journey, they face different threats along the entire route that they take. So not only are pesticides and herbicides a problem for the insect themselves, but it also affects their food sources. So if they can't find the food they need to actually make the journey, that's a huge issue.
So I think a lot of us would be familiar with the monarch butterfly in our gardens and when we're out for a walk or a hike or anything like that. Is it dangerous to touch them? And if we were to handle them, does it hurt the monarch butterfly?
So you won't be harmed if you touch them. It's a poison, so you actually have to consume it to be harmed by it. But we don't recommend you touch them because they are very delicate, and you know, you could easily hurt them by accident. So it's best just to observe them from afar, and sometimes they will land on you because, you know, they might want the salt off your skin. So you just let them kind of do their thing and they'll flutter off on their own.
How would you describe the size of the butterfly? How big do they actually get?
So they're about 10 centimeters across, so about, you know, about the width of your hand if you have about an average size hand.
I'm just looking at a couple of notes that I jotted down here before our conversation, Carter, and is it true that the monarch butterfly can taste with their feet?
Yes, it is. So the way the butterfly confirms that it is actually on a milkweed plant that it needs to lay its eggs, it will first kind of take visual cues to see it, and then it will fly over, sit on the plant, and it will taste to see if it is the correct species of plant.
All right, so their favorite food, milkweed. I have a picture of it right here, Carter. And where would someone most likely be able to find milkweed in Nova Scotia?
So there's two species of milkweed that grows in Nova Scotia. If you're towards the valley, you'll see more often the common milkweed, which has these fat and fuzzy leaves and the big round pink ball of flowers. And the second species is the swamp milkweed, which, like its name suggests, you'll likely find it on the edges of riverbeds and near swampy areas where it's wet. And this one has a more slender, green, elegant leaf and a smaller, umbel shape flower. But very often now you'll find it in people's gardens because they're trying to encourage monarchs.
Yes, you had mentioned that in the press release that people are trying to encourage and protect the monarchs. Why should we be concerned about their livelihood and be involved in this type of awareness campaign?
Well, a lot of people say that it's such a magnificent thing to see these monarchs, especially if you're lucky enough to see a gathering of monarchs on their way down south, because it's just such a magnificent event. But I mean, insects, not only the monarch, but all of our insect species are at risk at this point because of the things that are going on. And to see them leave is not only horrible, but it could affect the way that we live our lives with food production and pollination and so on and so forth. And to add to that, the fact that it's a species that kind of brings together not only Canada, but the U.S. and Mexico. It has been called a unifying species because of how many different people it can bring together.
So do you have any colleagues or have you met anyone for a working relationship in the U.S. or Mexico to communicate, to monitor the journey of the monarch butterfly?
I actually have a pen pal in Texas that always lets me know when they reach her house to let me know that they're on their way to me. We met through the Monarch Project. She reached out to me, and that's how I learn about when they're on their way every year. And she actually did come to visit me one year, and we connected. And it was such a neat way to come together and meet someone I would have never met otherwise.
How could anyone look at the monarch butterfly again the same way after learning this from you? Their orange and black colors, why that color scheme is necessary in protecting them, the amazing story that they could tell about that journey. It's really an awakening.
Well, that is pretty much why I wanted to do this project. I've been doing a lot of focused presentations lately, and I realize that a lot of people still don't know about monarchs or the amazing journey or the crazy things that kind of go on with the species and how it doesn't have a typical life cycle, and it has some generations that live twice as long as others. And I wanted to step back and just, you know, really focus on making people more aware of the species and the fact that it is endangered now.
From a researcher's point of view, what do we not know about the monarch butterfly? Is there still much to learn about them?
There are a lot of things we don't know. And of course, with every project, when you seek out answers for a question, you always find three more questions from that research. But we are looking into milkweed in Nova Scotia to see if there is enough for them. So we will be monitoring patches of milkweed next fall to look for monarch presence and kind of check in on how they're doing.
Carter, you certainly sound like someone who enjoys their job. What is it about this type of research that fascinates you and makes you want to learn more about the monarch butterfly?
Well, as somebody who started out with turtles originally, it's such an odd thing to go to a monarch where the lifespan is so much shorter and they are so delicate compared to turtles, but I've definitely gained an appreciation for all the different types of ways that creatures go about life and their different looks and their different sort of habits and how they are, but they all seem to have found their way no matter how different they look and how different they go about things. And I think we can learn a lot from just watching nature as it is and how it does its own thing.
Yeah, and now that you mention that, this part of the world, a small Canadian province like Nova Scotia, there certainly is a lot of variety here in plants and animals and insects.
Oh, I know, and I could probably go on a massive tangent about the incredible aspects of the genetics of species that are isolated to small islands, and Nova Scotia specifically, being at the northeastern edge of many populations, we have some of the most unique creatures here, even creatures that are found elsewhere, because we're so isolated, the ones we have are in themselves very unique and different from the ones that occur elsewhere in the world.
Oh, please go ahead, elaborate. We'd like to hear more.
Sure. Nova Scotia itself is pretty isolated in a sense because there's only that connection between New Brunswick, but any species that occurs on the South Shore, it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for them to get up towards New Brunswick, depending on how mobile they are. So my background being turtles, our turtles are so isolated here, specifically the Blanding's turtle, that they have developed some different habits because of they've had to adapt to this different environment compared to where they exist elsewhere. And because we're sort of on the edge on the coast, I'd like to think our butterflies are pretty strong little guys, and they hitch a ride on the coastal winds and go all the way down to Mexico, so they take advantage of the different environments that we have here.
All right. Thanks for that, Carter. Before we go, what would you like people to know about March for Monarchs?
So for this particular project, the March for Monarchs, we're very much just focusing on the roots of letting people know that we are here and we are working towards monarchs. And because it's winter and there's no plants right now, we just want people to get out and take a walk and think about monarchs and see if you can learn something new, or maybe teach a friend or a colleague something new about monarchs on a walk, and to let us know about your walk and if you learned anything new.
Okay, and for anyone who'd like to learn more about the Mercy Tobiatic Research Institute, where can they find that information?
Yes, so on Facebook, we are the Mercy Tobiatic Research Institute. Instagram is Mercy Tobiatic. You can email me directly at carter.feltham@mercytobiatic.ca. And we'll be posting all of this information throughout the month with different posts and fun facts about monarchs throughout the entire month that this awareness is going on. We'll be right back.
The Old Sydney Society, the Cape Breton Regional Library, and Hans from Cape Breton present In the Dead of Winter. It's a look at the darker side of the history of Sydney. Whether you believe in the paranormal or not, Jonathan Manley, who hasn't quite made up his mind yet, if there is another realm mingling with our reality, he talks about the North End, where some permanent residents seem to reveal themselves every now and then.
We decided to focus our efforts on the Cosset House in Sydney, and for people who are unaware of what the Cosset House is, it was the home of Reverend Rana Cosset, who was an Anglican minister in the 1700s and early 1800s. And he moved his family from, I believe it was Massachusetts, somewhere's in New England. I don't have my notes with me, sorry. But somewhere's in New England in the late 1700s. So he moved him and his wife and six of his children to Sydney to form a congregation. And also because he was kind of kicked out of where he was for being a loyalist to the British Crown. During the American Revolution, he came and he settled here along with a lot of other loyalists. But it wasn't an easy ride. He had a very turbulent relationship with a lot of different members of the community, including notable community members such as Archibald Dodd and another famous loyalist, David Matthews, who was actually imprisoned and escaped and came to Cape Breton for plotting to kill George Washington. So,
You mentioned Dave Matthews there. He's recognized over on Peter's Field on the other side of the harbor in the Westmount area. I believe he was a mayor from the New York area, and his estate was there at Peter's Field. Is that right?
Yes, his estate was over in Peter's Field, and the point in Peter's Field called Amelia Point is named after his daughter. And apparently they were they lived there until they David Matthews lived there until he passed, and then he was actually buried on the property. So his we're kind of thinking that his grave is a little bit out in the harbor now, but just trying to get an exact location is quite difficult because of erosion and the 300 years that have passed since then. So
okay, so back across the harbor to the North End in Sydney, the Hans from the Cape, you were given access to the Cosset House. So what was that like, John? What did you and your team discover?
Well, we did get some interesting evidence. Doug is our tech guy. He's the one going through the hours of footage and recordings that we did to try and isolate some of the sounds and videos and whatnot so that we can have them in this event. And I will say that when I was there, I did see one very, very interesting video that we are going to share at the event on Thursday. And I think it's very interesting. It's only a couple of seconds long, but it was, and the interesting thing is when you usually hear about ghost stories and paranormal stuff, your mind automatically thinks, oh, this is going to be, you know, a dark and dreary abandoned house in the middle of the night and very quiet. But this was taken in the middle of the day. It was only, I think it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a bright, sunny Sunday afternoon. And, you know, there was cars going by on Charlotte Street. And it was kind of bizarre for me to see firsthand. And I think that people are going to get find it very interesting.
So how do you go about documenting the sound or activity that would take place in a place like Cosset House? So what kind of technology is involved here?
So usually with our sounds, there are different classes of what are called electronic voices, electronic voice phenomenon, or EVPs for short. You hear that a lot in, like, when you talk about paranormal investigation. And for EVPs, the two main ones that you can get are from just asking a question with a recorder playing and nothing else in the background, and then just seeing if the recorder picks up anything that you didn't hear yourself. But then there's also a device that we use called a spirit box. And what that does is it is basically a random syllable generator, and it responds to fluctuations in electromagnetic fields. So basically the idea behind it is that if there is a spirit or entity present, that they can manipulate the electromagnetic fields and cause words to come out of this spirit box. Then there's also another device that we use that basically just scans AM/FM frequencies. And the point behind that is that, again, if there's a spirit or entity present, that it can use the frequencies on the radio that aren't being used by, you know, your radio station or other radio stations in town. So,
John, of course, there'd be a lot of people listening who would be skeptical to this type of phenomenon and paranormal activity, saying there must be a logical explanation for images or sounds that would appear to be from another time. But do you know of anyone who has been persuaded doing things like visiting the Cossett House?
I think I mentioned this one of the last times we spoke about a different event. But I'm the biggest skeptic in the group. I've never seen anything. A lot of my stuff comes from secondhand. The more that I investigate with the Haunts from the Cape group, the more I kind of am thinking, oh, there's got to be something here. I still haven't, signed on entirely, but I find it very interesting. But the most interesting part of it is when you get somebody who doesn't really believe, and then something happens, and they get so frightened by the experience that, like, they leave. For example, when we were out in Lewisburg, we were filming a location in the Duje house, and this person was kind of our the baseline. So they were standing in front of the camera and waving and making motions and things like that to just be our baseline. And then anyways, all of a sudden, the camera picked up something behind her, and all of the people watching the camera kind of gasped, and she said, "What's wrong?" And one of her friends said, "There's somebody standing right next to you on the camera." And she, I've never seen somebody move so fast and leave the house when she left that day. So it was kind of interesting to see somebody else's reaction.
That just reminded me to ask you something else. This is a building that is on the north end. I believe it's not far away from the Cossett House. I can't seem to remember which side of the street this building is on, but apparently a home had to be moved towards the backyard because of the homeowners at the time. They felt that they had some unexpected visitors, and their house was actually physically moved. Do you know what I'm talking about there?
Yeah, that's a story that I learned when I was on one of the ghost walks that the Old Sydney Society puts on during the summer. It's been a few years since I did. Claire Roach would be a better person to talk to about that, or one of the staff that does the ghost walks. But what I do remember was that there was a house on Charlotte Street. Yes, on Charlotte Street down the north end. And what happened was that the house was haunted, and the person ended up getting fed up with the ghost, and so found out that they could just move the house back a bit and it wouldn't be on the site that the ghost was haunting. So they just moved it backwards, and that's the legend of that house with the big front yard on Charlotte Street.
You know, I just remember reading a grisly story about the history of that building, that it was a place where some prisoners were taken and forgotten about. and it that story didn't have a very happy ending.
Again, like I said, it's been years since I've taken the ghost tour, but I do know that they have a really good story that goes with it, and I do know that actually the old jail is also on Charlotte Street, and it was a psychologist's or psychiatrist's office for a while there, and apparently the old cells are still visible in the basement, but unfortunately that's a place that is a private residence slash office, so we can't get in there to confirm or deny that one, but that's another thing that's on the old Sydney Society's ghost tours. So
you know, John, I have to tell you about that house, the Dixon House, if I'm not mistaken. I was actually in that house. It was a friend that I have. She grew up in the north end of Sydney, and I remember being there and asking to see the basement where the jails were, and her parents didn't think it was a good idea, but we were certainly intrigued.
That's really interesting, and that's what we really love about events like this, is that not only do we get a chance to, you know, come out and show who we are and show, you know, the different things that are available in downtown Sydney through the McConnell Library, but also the Old Sydney Society, and then, you know, what we do at Haunts from the Cape to kind of further the historical research and knowledge that our community has. But also getting people out and hearing their stories is absolutely amazing, because that's what really fuels what we do as part of Haunts from the Cape, is, you know, like, we get stories from people and then we take it and we investigate it through historical research. And that's always super interesting to do, and especially when you have a starting location. And so these events, usually I like the one next Thursday at the McConnell is 6 to 8, and I was saying I'm going to schedule an hour for, you know, talking and showing EVPs and videos, but also I'm going to leave about an hour to 45 minutes to talk to people about their experiences, so that we can, you know, collect these experiences and go from there.
Okay, and just before we go, John, the presentation is called In the Dead of Winter. Where can people learn more about this?
You can visit the Cape Breton Regional Library's website, just under the events page. It's on March 9th, so it's there. I will say that it is coming close to being at full capacity, but because it filled up so quickly, we're thinking about another event possibly down at with, because this one was put on by me. The other one will be put on maybe at the Old Sydney Society. So just, you know, stay tuned to our website and our Facebook and everything like that, and the Old Sydney Society's Facebook and website, and as well as Haunts from the Cape, and we'll definitely make some posts as to when they become available.
All right, that's Jonathan Manley with Haunts from the Cape and the Cape Breton Regional Library. Thanks again, as usual, John. It's always great to talk to you, and hopefully we'll get a chance to chat again soon.
Okay, sounds good, Bill.
And Bill Bradley is going to wrap up the show again for us this week with his guest Mark Bott, recognizing some of the best to come out of the Cape Breton music scene.
It was almost 1 year ago that CB Mike, Cape Breton Music Industry Cooperative, announced 4 artists from Cape Breton Island that will be inducted into the Cape Breton Music Hall of Fame: Rita McNeil, Buddy McDonald, Matt Minglewood, and Men of the Deeps. And it's my pleasure to welcome to the program one of the board members from CB Mike, Mark Bott. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, Mark, before we even went through the process of doing this last April, tell us about the process of how you chose the artist going to be inducted coming up this April at Center 200.
It was a choice of the board of directors of the Cape Breton Music Industry Cooperative. We were kind of plugged into a lot of the Cape Breton, you know, professional music scene. You know, we had to look very carefully affiliate who we were going to induct. The big thing to remember is that this is the first induction. It's definitely not the last induction. We're going to eventually get to absolutely everybody, and we know that we can't please everybody the first time around, and so people will always have their opinions about who should have been in what year. But we feel great about these nominees between Rita, Matt, and the Men of the Deeps. Like, we have three iconic musical acts from the island, and the song "Getting Dark Again" by Buddy McDonald is known the world over as a fantastic piece of Cape Breton music.
This is the very first one. It's coming up April 20th. That's a Thursday night at Center 200, right?
That is correct.
Is like Minglewood going to perform, or is it going to be Buddy McDonald performing? I'm assuming other people are going to be performing their songs, and they're just going to sit back and be part of the show, so to speak.
I mean, this is a night for them to enjoy with their families. This is a night that hopefully they'll remember, or in the case of folks who are predeceased, that their families will remember. So absolutely, it'll be a tribute show. So we're putting together basically a who's who list of Cape Breton musicians, you know, some familiar faces, and hopefully a few surprises in there. And we're going to put together a stellar show like only Cape Breton can. And it'll be broken up into parts. There'll be tributes to Rita, to Matt, to the Men of the Deeps, to Getting Dark Again. And it'll be a fantastic show for everybody.
Well, the Coast 89.7, as you know, playing all of these local artists, and so glad to be on board as a sponsor. How could we not be with all of these great musicians? And this is the very first one, as we mentioned, coming up April 20th at Center 200. This will actually start off a process of getting a new home to actually showcase the music at Nova Scotia Community College. Tell us a bit about that with the, of course, the new campus.
NSCC has come on board along with yourselves as a great sponsor for this event and this project. The Hall of Fame will have a physical installation component to it, and part of that will exist in the new theater at NSCC. And then other parts of it will be spread around the island. You know, the Hall of Fame is going to be bigger than just one location, because the island is bigger than just one city. It's important to have elements of the Hall of Fame not only exist physically, but also virtually and in different locations. The idea is, you know, as many of us often say, Cape Breton is the music island. So to have the Hall of Fame kind of spread across the island so that both locals and tourists alike can enjoy it no matter where they are.
After this is all said and done, after April 20th, when do you start to pick the next selection of artists, and how does that process go?
Well, we'll be starting fairly soon to put together the committee to pick the next selection of artists. This selection was chosen by the board of CD Mike, but that'll be the only time that we do that. We're building a committee filled with, you know, our members and members of the musical community from across Cape Breton Island, and then we'll have a lengthy search process to put together the nominees, and we'll announce them in a similar fashion as we did last time.
Now, there were four picked for this one, and the very first four, so will it continue in groups of four, or have you decided that yet or not?
Nothing's been finalized, but likely four isn't a hard and fast number, so it's three individuals and a song this year, but in subsequent years, it could be somebody from the industry, somebody from the live events industry, could be somebody from the radio industry. And there's more people that go into supporting the music industry than just singers and musicians. So no, it's not a hard and fast rule as to how many. You know, we do know that we have, you know, a lot of fantastic Cape Breton musical talent, but it's not an unlimited pool. So we want to make sure that we can have these celebrations for years to come.
So how does CB Mike factor into this?
CB Mike is the Music Industry Association for Cape Breton Island. So if you think of, say, Music Nova Scotia or Music PEI, we're that for Cape Breton. Because of Cape Breton's rich musical culture and vibrant musical industry, Cape Breton has its own Music Industry Association. That's why we get the ECMAs every 5 years. Hall of Fame acts as a fundraiser for CB Mike. So what we do with money raised in this is we reinvest it into artists. So we do album support, where we contribute to recording albums. We help artists tour. We'll be establishing and integrating a scholarship fund where money raised from the Hall of Fame will go to support Cape Bretoners attending various musical programs. We're working on some projects right now where we can get more musical instruments in the hands of more kids. Basically, the money that we raise during the Hall of Fame is reinvested so that the music industry stays strong, and that in 50 years we have even more people to induct in the Hall of Fame.
So this event that's coming up on April 20th, how can you get a ticket?
So the tickets will be on sale through Ticketmaster at Center 200, or by reaching up to CB Mike at cbmike.ca. But the tickets will be on sale right through Ticketmaster, so they can be purchased either at the Center 200 box office or online.
So is there going to be a limited amount of tickets or as many as you can sell? How's that going to work?
It'll be as many as we can sell. There'll be tickets on the floor in kind of tables, but also it'll be roughly half of the lower bowl instead of 200. So the stage will be kind of side on. So sections 1 through 12, I believe, will be for sale as well as if we need it, portions up the upper bowl. The tickets will be affordable. So the idea is music is for everyone. The idea is to bring in as many people as possible to enjoy the show without capacity or price being a limiting factor.
Well, we appreciate this and so glad to be partnered with the CB Mic and the first ever CB Mic Industry Hall of Fame.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you for your support and sponsorship. Without radio stations like yours, or especially the Coast, the music industry in Cape Breton wouldn't be what it is today.
This week, thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.